This program was first broadcast on Otago Access Radio and made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.
Sustainable Lens, Resilience on Radio. Hear an informed, intelligent and provocative discussion of sustainability issues every week. It's brought to you by Otago Polytechnic, where all students learn how to make their industries more sustainable. The regular panel of Samuel Mann and Shane Gallagher are hosted by Anton Angelo and joined every week by a leading figure in the sustainability scene. Politics, science and controversy on Sustainable Lens on Radio, tonight at 7 o'clock, a podcast on www.sustainablelens.org or www.oar.org.nz.
Tonight we're joined by our regular panellists, Professor Samuel Mann, and your host is me, Shane Gallagher. And our guest tonight is Professor Sir Alan Mark, who's an Emeritus Professor in Botany Department here at Otago University. Welcome to our show. So I'm going to start off with my number of the week, which is 1.2. That is 1.2% of the total materials used after 6 weeks remain as useful product. Now, what does that mean? Well, it means that of the 100% of the materials used to make anything, like an iPhone or a car or whatever, only 1.2% of that material is usable after 6 weeks when you've got the product. So you've got basically 98.8% of any given product goes to waste. And this is a pretty dramatic statistic that just come out from the United Nations, and this really shows you how wasteful modern manufacturing processes are. And give you another example is that 94% of all materials involved in production process is waste before the product isn't even sold. So 6% is the product that you get in your hand, and after the 94% of waste, and then after 6 weeks, only 1.2% of that any manufactured product is useful. And it just goes to show how resource intensive our modern lifestyle is, and that's something that's is unsustainable. Nature doesn't allow this kind of level of waste. It recycles everything. You have 100% recycling of every product, nothing goes to waste, but in our manufactured world, only 1.2% is usable after 6 weeks, which is quite sobering. So we're just going to have a quick promo from our sponsors.
At Otago Polytechnic, we've made a commitment to sustainability in all that we do. High quality, hands-on education is our trademark, and it's delivered with a focus on sustainable practice. We even have a school dedicated to it, our Centre for Sustainable Practice. For more information, check out our website, otagopolytechnic.ac.nz. A bright future is a sustainable future. Otago Polytechnic, proud sponsor of Sustainable Lens.
So tonight we're skipping Sam's thought for the week because he's busily thinking about a wedding.
Not my wedding.
Not his wedding. But his daughter-in-law's wedding.
That's right.
Yes, and congratulations to Shan. And it's very, very exciting. That's happening next weekend, is it?
This weekend.
This weekend. Oh, my God. That's incredible. So, but we also, the other reason is because we have Professor Sir Alan Mark, or Emeritus Professor Sir Alan Mark, to give him his full title.
Thank you.
And he's a something of a legend in New Zealand. So he's just released a book called Above the Tree Line, which is the 40th anniversary of Lake Manapouri Guardians. And Alan got his knighthood recently. You had a quite convoluted way of getting your knighthood. Can you tell us the story?
Yeah, well, there were several in the same situation. The previous Labour government decided they would abandon the regular royal honours and institute some New Zealand honours, specifically New Zealand. So they did away with knighthoods and damehoods and established what they called Distinguished Companions of the New Zealand Order of Merit. So I was awarded one of those in 2002, and had no difficulty accepting that. It was for work on conservation, I think mainly on the Manapouri issue. So that was a pretty exciting to get a recognition of conservation as at that level, because we're often considered to be sort of anti-development, anti-issues generally. But really, in the Manapouri case, we fought for and finally achieved a satisfactory integration of that unique environment of the Fiordland Lakes with the hydroelectric development of them. That was a major campaign, a 13-year campaign. The whole country was involved. It was, I think, the petition on the Manapouri, Save Manapouri, was the largest to that time, 260,000-odd signatures. And that reflected, I think, the attitude of New Zealanders as a whole to despoiling the two magnificent lakes, the gateway to Fiordland, our most prestigious national park. I happened to be more involved in that because out of the blue came a request from the Electricity Department via DSIR back in 1979 to do an assessment of the likely impacts of lake raising on the plants of the lake shore, the stability of the lake shore, and the general aesthetics of it. And I had a honour student at the time, Peter Johnson, who was keen to do work on wetlands and lakes, so he did an exercise as his honours project, and I supervised it. Not quite aware at that time of just the controversial political issue I was getting into. So, it became a major issue for the New Zealand as a whole. It became a major issue in the 1972 election, which was a landslide to Labour with Norman Kirk as the leader, and the Labour Party at the time, in opposition, had a policy of not raising either of the lakes, regardless of what appeared to be a legal commitment to do so, which previous governments had signed up with the Consolidated Zinc Aluminium Company. So that was the outcome of the 1972 election. But soon after the results of the election, I think the Labour government now in power, Norman Kirk in particular, suggested he would take advice on lake management from those who had been campaigning. So he established the Manapouri Te Anau Lake Guardians from six of us who had been spearheading the campaign, and gave us the job of advising on lake management to ensure that in the use of the lakes for hydroelectric generation, and they're already developed for that, to supply the aluminium smelter at Bluff, in it, the use of the lakes for hydro generation to ensure that the lakes themselves would not be damaged. So that was quite a challenge. I was made chairperson of the group, so we could apply some of the information we had already obtained through our ecological work and exercise in applied ecology, and it worked like a charm. And at the same time, we certainly got involved deeply in public relations, and we had the country behind us. So I was the chairperson of the Guardians there for the first 26 years, and since 1999 I haven't been involved directly, but I watch it with interest. The Guardians are still there, overseeing the management of the lakes, and when you look at the lakes now, they look natural as they basically are. The lakes are operated within their natural ranges and produce a substantial amount of electricity. And in fact, there are signs down there, both in Te Anau and Manapouri, declaring a world first. This is the power company themselves now, proud of the fact that these magnificent lakes are being used within their natural levels for a major hydro generation and retained in their natural state. So they've referred to it as a world first, which is reassuring after the big battles we were on, particularly with the engineers and the power companies at the time. We've all agreed now that we've got a really satisfactory compromise.
Was it a shock for a mild-mannered botanist to suddenly find himself in a political turmoil and managing public relations, whereas before you were counting tussocks and
yeah,
was quietly walking around in the mountains?
A very different exercise, for sure. But, I was provoked, I suppose, by the engineers of the day, virtually playing God. They claimed publicly that when they managed Manapouri, they would improve on nature. Even with the lake Manapouri raised 27 metres, they would control the levels, and they claimed improve on nature. And when they got concerned that they may not achieve their ambitions, they were groping for straws, really. I think misleading uninformed public. They had all sorts of suggestions. One was, believe it or not, harnessing the Sutherland Falls if they couldn't raise Manapouri. That was a mind-boggling proposal. Another one was diverting the Holyford River. That would be a major exercise too, diverting it through the Alps. So we just accused them of trying to mislead an uninformed public, scaremongering basically, and it didn't work. But anyhow, and in fact, just before the election, when Norman Kirk went to have a look at one of the lakeshore clearing exercises, all the stumps were still on the lakeshore, the result of their little experiment there. And apparently the electricity department's general manager at the time said these stumps were natural. And when Norman Kirk was referred to these stumps being natural, according to the electricity department, he said, so I'm told, yes, I could believe that. He said, these people think they're so close to God, anything they do can be classed as natural. So, I mean, that was the attitude at the time. I must say the engineering profession has matured a lot. I think most of their students now take environmental courses. They're aware of the environment, they appreciate the environment, and much more respectful of the environment than back in those days.
I want to come on later in the hour to talking about some of the proposals that are around at the moment, but I want to take a step back first and talk about your background before that sort of rise to fame.
Right.
Did you head off to university knowing you wanted to be a botanist?
No, not really. I went to Montague District High School from Dunedin doing the agricultural course, and my folks couldn't afford to send me to Lincoln, so I went to Otago University. The folks had not been associated with university before. And, I was impressed by botany as a subject. I was very impressed by the botany staff in the department, and they were very encouraging. So, it didn't take long to realise that I had a great interest in botany, and particularly field botany, and particularly the ecological aspects, sort of relating plants in the wild, vegetation in the wild, to management of the vegetation. And, of course, I worked on Mangatua near the Tairi Plain for my master's, and that was an area of high country. And there were some issues there of high country management, and I could see some obvious cases of mismanagement. In fact, they're all through the high country. And then I went to the States and did a PhD with a Fulbright grant, North Carolina, Duke University. Came back in 1959 and got a job with the Otago Catchment Board as one of a two-person high country survey team or research team, and spent some time in the Otago high country. The problem there was degradation of the high country. That job didn't really work out. The Catchment Board really wasn't up to researchers doing that sort of research. So,
were you involved in setting up the condition and trend line transaction?
We certainly did some, but Lands and Survey themselves were involved in that all around the high country because they were equally concerned about the degradation. But anyhow, out of the blue came an offer for the first fellowship of a newly established high country research trust, the Helleby Indigenous Grass and Research Trust. And they offered me their first fellowship, which was a challenging exercise to review the literature and indulge in some of the research that I could see was outstandingly necessary. So that got me involved in looking at the high country in the late 50s, early 60s. Up to that time, the general concern was, and the government was concerned, and they had had their team of prominent ecologists doing an assessment of the high country, all based on observation. There'd been really no detailed research, and their conclusion was that all the tussocks in the high country were relic, no longer in tune with the environment, and all pastoral farming was doing was sort of hastening the demise of the tussock grassland. So that was the sort of scene when I got started in 1960, and doing some detailed work on the effects of burning and grazing and measuring the plant growth and responses. It was very clear to me that these plants were highly adapted to their environment. What was the problem was how they were being managed by most of the high country farmers, burning frequently and then not spelling after fire. And the effect of grazing straight after fire was really highly detrimental on the plants. And there were some classic examples of small areas being burnt and the tussocks being killed within a few months, even though these plants are so long-lived. In fact, I'm in record of saying they're potentially immortal, the way they just turn over. But give them abuse with high country farming and you can kill them within a few months. And once killed, they're virtually impossible to replace. So there was a lot to be learnt there. And some of that information went over reasonably well with some farmers, but others were just totally opposed to it, tried to undermine my credibility, because they were very traditional farmers and they didn't see the merits of what I was doing and certainly my findings. So it took a long while really to get the information accepted widely, and there was a fair bit of debate at the time, but now I think most of the run holders and certainly the authorities overseeing the management of the High Country accept that grazing is a delicate operation, particularly after fire, and the management of these High Country areas is a very important issue. But there's been so much degradation up till this stage. Many of our mountains in Canterbury and west and south and the Takatimus, you know, they're in a sorry state, and they'll take centuries to recover, really.
So what kind of damage does the overgrazing do? I mean, obviously just soil erosion, but are there other effects?
Well, the tussocks form quite an impressive cover. In fact, if you walk through an area of tall tussock, you know, it's quite a challenge to get through it. The point of the burning is to reduce all that rank grass and the litter and expose the base of the tussock. Then the tussocks start recovering from that fire by producing new green leaves. And those green leaves are produced at the cost of most of the nutrients in the roots and the stem. So those new leaves after fire are very nutritious. And if there's a choice to be made between recently burned and unburned plants, the stock will sense out the higher palatability, the higher nutrient value of the fresh growth, and zero in on it. And depending on the size of the area burnt, if it's a small area, they'll demolish it within a month or two, because the new foliage is green, it's palatable, it's succulent almost, and it's got all the nutrients of the plants going into it, so it's highly nutritious. And grazing animals are simply able to pick the more nutritious plants from among what's offering. So that my advice to the farmers was pure burn. If you're going to burn, you burn a large area, you burn the whole block, basically, and then you spell for a year, preferably 2 years, until the plants have sort of re-established themselves before you graze them and start to hammer that new growth. And that way, I think the plants could cope. But that's been a hard message to get across, because traditional farming in the High Country has been basically burn in the early spring and put the stock back in within a month or two. So that's been a hard lesson to get across, more so with some than with others. And yeah, we've had some battle royals with some run holders who have been doing their best to undermine the credibility of my work. I also did some work on water production in the High Country, and that was very interesting, because I'd seen some work done in Scotland with small tanks and putting vegetation in the tanks and measuring what goes in as rainfall and what comes out the bottom as surplus, and the difference is, of course, what goes back into the atmosphere as evaporation and transpiration. So we got involved with that in the mid-60s, and right from the beginning, very surprising, the big tussocks gave us the best water yield, better than burnt tussocks, grazed tussocks, even better than bare soil. And that was most surprising, and that again upset many run holders, because they particularly weren't in favour of tall, rank tussocks. They wanted it short. In fact, many of them would prefer no tussocks at all. So that message took a long while to get across, and again, some of the run holders, some of the more redneck run holders, were determined to undermine that research and went about it in rather strange ways, underhand really, and got to the result of the situation of even recommending to the Vice Chancellor that he resign me from the university. So there were some rough patches there as well, not just with Manapouri, but with some of these High Country issues. But now I think it's generally agreed that, and Dunedin City has purchased a large area out here on the Lamalores, the upper deep stream catchment, where we get 60% of our city's water coming off those snow tussock grasslands. They're fantastic yielders of water. We've got results there from our measurements that indicate that about 60% of the rain that falls goes into the streams and is available for use. In some situations, some sites at high altitude with a lot of fog, we get 80% of the measured rainfall is surplus, comes out the bottom of the tanks. And that's world record stuff. So these tussocks are extremely conservative of water. They evaporate very little. They seem to have adapted to minimising water use, even though they're growing where there's more than adequate water for
them. Are they actively catching fog?
And they're actively catching fog. If there's fog around, they'll catch it. In fact, we did some experiments up here on Mount Cargill, where, of course, it gets a lot of coastal fog. We could see it from Dunedin when the fog was there. We brought tussocks in to Mount Cargill, cached them up there in a damp patch, and when the fog was there, went up and put them out over buckets to measure what they could catch. And a single tussock in a fog with no measurable rainfall could catch half a litre of water in an hour, just a single tussock. And when we added more tussocks around it, a single tussock caught less than one on its own. But if you looked at it on an area basis, a square metre or something, they caught more water with several tussocks than one on its own. So, yeah, we could demonstrate that these plants, with their very fine, long leaves wafting in the wind, are very efficient at stripping the water out of fog.
When you were... I don't know if the words you were using were battle, but when you were having these disagreements with these farmers, did it stay seemly? Was it a gentlemanly discussion, or did it get unpleasant?
Some of their methods were a bit underhand, I thought. But, yeah, I've always insisted on keeping talking to these people to try to convince them that talk these things through, demonstrate in the field. And we've had some good field trips with farmers debating these issues. And, I think it's very important to keep talking to these people. And I think most of them have now been convinced. And, in fact, Landcare Research themselves have done some catchment studies. They were concerned that these tanks we were using were pretty Mickey Mouse. Hydrologists use big catchments, 250 hectares, and put a big V-notch weir at the base and measure what comes out of the catchment. So even the forestry hydrologists were intrigued with our study, so they put a couple of catchments side by side up in the Laumaroa's at Glendu Forest. They planted one in Pinus radiata and left the other as tussock. And that's been a very interesting exercise. Out of the tussock catchment, they got virtually the same as we were getting, about 65% yield on their measured rainfall. The catchment they planted in pines, they calibrated it for the first few years, decided they were both recording the same effects, and no effect of the forest for the first 6 or 7 years. But beyond that, then the yield from the pine catchment started to go down, and after 23 years, it's down 43%. So, I mean, it's declining fast. So that's one of the issues that we've been very concerned about, this promotion of tree planting, exotic forestry for carbon and forestry, wood generally, and particularly for carbon capture, carbon sequestration, is in many of these areas at a great cost to the water, because where water is important as a product from these mountains, then we believe the value of water is probably greater than the value of carbon that's sequestered by putting a pine forest in these areas. And it's still happening. We've just been concerned with Landcare Research planting 180 hectares of Douglas fir right up at high 800 metres on the Laumaroa's, right within stone's throw of Te Papanui Conservation Park, which is downwind. They said they put it there for timber and particularly carbon. We say that's a shocking place to plant them, and even their consultants, forestry consultants, said the wilding threat is very high. So there's a small patch, 190 hectares of Douglas fir getting established, which is going to shed seed into a pristine area of tussock grassland where their consultants have told them that the wilding problems will be high. And, you know, that really does concern me when a government SOE, supposed to be a good neighbour, will threaten a pristine area of conservation land by planting a patch of potentially serious threat virtually upwind of it.
Do you consider yourself to be an activist?
Oh, I think so. Yeah, I mean, I'm willing to speak out. It's important, I think, for scientists to actually reveal their findings to the general public. Some of them are controversial, and it's the nature of the work I think I do that in ecological areas. But it's important to realise that I think that academics, university scientists, are privileged in a way that government scientists are not, because government scientists are absolutely constrained in what they can say publicly, particularly in areas as they're told, particularly in areas of their own expertise. They have to clear it with the boss, and the boss has to, no doubt, satisfy the political masters of the day. So, we don't hear much from government scientists on controversial issues. Mm. It's the exception. Academics are privileged as being what's referred to as the critic and conscience of society. So that's a huge privilege, and it also carries a huge responsibility to stick with your own information, your credible information, and convey that to the public so they can assess it, and other managers can assess it, debate it in public, and hopefully benefit from the outcome.
Have you ever been wrong?
In minor ways, no, I don't think so. I mean, we learn as we go. We get some interest, like the water yield stuff. I mean, our first study there showed us that the Big Tussocks have the greatest yield of water. We were as puzzled about that as the hydrologists, the professional hydrologists, and probably the run holders. So we decided we'd really look into this and see what was going on. And over the years, we've sort of refined our methods and added to our research approach. And right now, we're absolutely convinced that we've got the answer. And I think we've convinced most of the others that that's the situation too.
Let's move on to and talk about the very impressive book that we've got sitting in front of us.
Yeah.
So tell us how this came about.
Well, when I was overseas, my first study leave abroad in 1966, I was so impressed with the number of books available overseas, particularly in Europe, guides to the plants of the area, forest guides, alpine guides. And when I came back, I decided, you know, New Zealand really could do with a useful guide to some of our amazing alpine areas. I'd been working in the Alpine, so I had some idea of the magnificence of the plants there. Talked to friends, and they suggested that I should discuss it with a botanical artist, which I did, and Nancy Adams, who worked for the National Museum at the time, and she was keen to, she was a trained botanical artist, so we put together a book called New Zealand Alpine Plants, published in 1973, and that was pretty successful, and that was published by Reeds, and then Reeds did a review of it in 1986, and then by chance, the British Alpine Garden Group was coming to New Zealand in 1996 for a tour of New Zealand and wanted to know whether there was any alpine books that were going to be available for them. My own was out of print by that time, so Godwood in Auckland organised with Reeds to allow them to take over the revision of the New Zealand alpine plants. So 1995, it was reviewed again, and that was pretty successful. And but a lot's happened since then. And Craig Potten, publishers, 2.5 years ago, I think it was, said, you know, would I be willing to review, revise that alpine book and bring it up to date? Well, that was a nice challenge, and I thought I could cope with that. And they said, well, you know, we'd like to make this book really comprehensive, not just the plants, not just the flowering plants, but the lower plants, the lichens and the fungi and the mosses and the liverworts, and what about the animals, you know? Let's make it comprehensive. So I thought that'd be fantastic. So very soon we organised a group of other people who were willing to contribute their knowledge, and so it's now called A Nature Guide to Alpine New Zealand. So it's got sections on the lower plants, it's got section on the birds and the lizards and the invertebrates, and the wetters, and the it's pretty comprehensive, rather than a botanical artist this time, since Nancy Adams is no longer with us, we decided we would canvass photographers, and as we know, there's a lot of keen alpine photographers around, and that was a challenge for the publishers. Jane Connor of Craig Potten's organised the many alpine photographers, and I think we've used 69 of them there, all submitted willingly what they had, and we screened them and selected them, and there are a range of photographs there, but I think most of them are very high quality. And, of course, I accept that illustrations sell a book rather than the dry text. So, yeah, the illustrations are magnificent, beautifully laid out. And altogether, I think it's, yeah, it does look impressive, and it seems to be getting good reception from all those who I've had a chance to talk to. And botanical colleagues were very helpful also. So, yeah, a lot of advice from outside, because I hadn't been active in botany for the 12 years of my retirement. So it was a bit of a challenge to catch up, and there was quite a lot of change over that 15 years.
Classification of things?
Classification, yeah. A lot of molecular work, DNA work, which had revolutionized some of the plant groups, and a few new discoveries. So there was quite a job in bringing it up to date, and what I've done is use the old names or indicate where the old names have been superseded. And most people, of course, will know these plants by their previous name. So anything that's changed since the last book came out in 1995, I've indicated the old name there in the book, so that to help people to sort of transfer to using the new names.
What's special about the New Zealand alpine environment?
Well, the alpine environment in New Zealand is similar to alpine environments in most parts of the world. It's too cold for trees. Well, a lot of people are intrigued, particularly overseas visitors come from New Zealand and say, how come, you know, the alpine in New Zealand starts at such a low altitude, 1,500 metres in the central North Island down to about at 900 metres in the Fiordland? That's an effective latitude. How come it's so low here? Well, the results for that are pretty clear. It's summer temperatures, or the temperatures of the growing season, that really determine pretty much what plants will grow where. And tree line in New Zealand, which is relatively low on a world standard, has pretty much the same temperatures at those altitudes as you get at 2 to 3 times those altitudes in continental countries like the European Alps or continental USA, the Rocky Mountains and so on. So, yeah. Our mountains are relatively low by international standards. The snow line is relatively low. There's about 1,000 metres elevation between the tree line and the snow line. And it's got an amazing collection of plants. There's about 750, I think, in the book, the flowering plants, and about 93% of them don't occur elsewhere outside New Zealand. So what we call endemism, confinement to New Zealand, is very high in the alpine. It's about 80% for the New Zealand plants in general, but about 93% for the alpine plants.
Is that the floating arc thing? Is that why it's such high percent like that?
Well, I think the environment is pretty conducive to evolution. A lot of the plants are pretty variable. And we get a lot of hybridization in New Zealand, hybrids between species, even occasional hybrids between what I refer to as different genera, which is most unusual. And, I mean, the alpine zone in New Zealand is relatively recent by world standards. It might sound long, ancient in human life terms, but, you know, about 3 million, 4 million years ago, when the Southern Alps started to come up with major mountain movements. So that's relatively recent in terms of plant evolution. And we used to think that a lot of our plants originated from Gondwana land and have been here for that long period of time, 80 million years since New Zealand separated from the other land masses of Gondwana. But the recent DNA work has indicated that quite a lot of our plants, particularly alpine plants, have arrived in New Zealand relatively recently, since the mountains were formed. And undergone very rapid evolution in New Zealand. So there's a lot of variety there. There's a lot of variability within some species. And that's, I think, a reflection of the very dynamic environment we have. Not only earthquakes, but mountains that are pretty erodible, and severe weather conditions, intense rainfall on the western side of the mountains, extreme temperatures to the east of the Southern Alps, and it's a pretty variable alpine environment around the country. Volcanic mountains in the North Island, and hard granite in northwest Nelson and in Fiordland, and high mountains and central Alps, so it's a pretty variable environment, and I think the variety of the alpine plants reflects that environmental variation.
And there's peculiar things like the particularly spiky ones and the ones with the internal environments and that sort of things. There's interesting morphologies and things as well.
That's right, yeah. Well, a lot of people find our plants, our alpine plants, rather dull on the basis that most of the flowers are white, some yellow. Some will have a bit of colour. Interestingly, some will have colour in the bud before the flowers open, but they open white. So that clearly white's got an advantage for the plants in some way, and it seems to be that it's in pollination. That's the most effective method for pollinating, and the pollinating insects, for the most part, are pretty primitive. A lot of our plants are pretty primitive in terms of their flower structure. So, it seems to work fairly well. There's been quite a bit of work done recently on pollination in the alpine plants, and it seems like the pollinators are pretty efficient. I mean, quite a few of our plants, I think about 13% of our alpine plants have separate male and female plants, which is rather unusual, like animals. And you wonder why it's so high in New Zealand. It seems to me that if you get separate male and female plants, then you're going to require cross-pollination, cross-fertilisation. And that, of course, ensures maximum genetic variation. So the acephalas, the big spear grasses, have separate male and female plants. And we look at the plants late in the year, about this time of the year, the female plants are fruiting, and the fruit's prolific. So that even though they're separate male and female plants, the pollination is clearly highly efficient. And that's a reflection of, I think, the insects we have, and most of them are native insects that do the pollination, are pretty efficient, even though they're relatively primitive themselves and the plants themselves have pretty unspecialised flowers.
Do you have a favourite plant?
not really, I don't think, no. You have a favourite landscape. I mean, the alpine landscapes in New Zealand are fantastic. We spend a lot of time in Fiordland and Mount Burns there in southeastern Fiordland, accessible now from the transmission line road from Monowai through to Lake Manapouri. Gives us very good access onto magnificent Fiordland Mountains. There's one of the world's largest landslides there, just adjacent to Mount Burns, 27 cubic kilometres, if you can imagine that. 9 kilometres long, 3 wide and 1 deep. It's massive. And you look at it and scratch your head, but when you're told it's a landslide, all you can say is, wow. But, it's what we call a biodiversity hotspot. There's a real rich assemblage of alpine plants there, matched only by Northwest Nelson, which is probably the most biodiverse of all of the alpine areas. But then you go to Central Otago and you've got it scorched earth up there. I mean, you're down to cushion fields a centimetre high. And when you're up there on a typical day, it's obvious why. I mean, the winds are screaming, and any plant that put its head flowers or leaves up, more than 10 centimetres would have them whipped off in the ice storms and howling winds that come through there. So, there's a lot of variety, and the screes themselves, our scree plants on the screes of Canterbury and Marlborough are amazing plants in terms of their adaptation to that hostile environment. And then we've got the vegetable sheep, which of course is probably our best known alpine plant. Most alpine botanists from overseas, that's the number one plant for them to check out on. They're just amazing. The well-named vegetable sheep, from a distance you think, has that moved or not? It certainly looks like a sheep. You go up to it and it's a woolly cushion plant, about the size and shape of a sheep. So there's some pretty amazing plants there. And I've tried to sort of highlight those, and the description of the plant is accompanied by the photographs, and then we talk about the habitat of the plant, where it occurs and where it is geographically, and what its altitudinal distribution is. So and we have to make it user friendly.
And on some of them you've got the threat status.
Got the what?
You've got whether or not it's threatened or endangered and so
that's
on.
That's right. Yeah, the alpine plants aren't as highly threatened, I think, as many of our lowland plants. They've been pretty resilient, really, holding in there. They're pretty well adapted to those environments. But we have got some plants that are clearly threatened. I mean, we've got a couple of forget-me-nots in central Otago on the Dunstan Mountains there, running between Cromwell and St. Bathans. Very interesting mountain range, and it's got a threatened forget-me-not in the northern end and another threatened forget-me-not at the southern end. And they're sitting right on the top of the mountain, and they're fairly limited in their distribution. In fact, one of them, the northern one, Myosotis aureopola, has only been found there since the mid-80s, and we've been monitoring it now for 15 years, and it occupies less than half a hectare, but its total population, we reckon, ranges from 13,000 to 22,000 plants. Turns over fairly rapidly, but it hasn't moved an inch. But if that was subject to global warming, then it's got virtually nowhere to go. It's a pretty uniform environment there, and if plants are forced to rise in altitude in adjusting to global warming, as they've demonstrated they are doing in the European Alps, then these plants will virtually have nowhere to go. So there's certainly a threat of global warming with our alpine plants, and some more than others. But yeah, there's certainly an interesting range there, but most of our mountains are high enough with permanent snow above the alpine plants themselves that they can probably got room to migrate in response to global warming. But some of these plants in central Otago that are sitting on the mountaintops could well be in dire strait.
As we said before, you're well known for this activism around and active work in the governance, setting up the governance structures for Manapouri, and you've been doing all this other work. But in your retirement, you haven't slowed down on that at all. You've been involved in several other campaigns.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, in retirement, you've got a chance to pick and choose which issues you'll get involved with. And I've been involved with Forest and Bird Protection Society since the mid-80s, really, when we lost a case for conserving part of the Waipori Station, the Nadu catchment. We had nine ecologists, government and university. We had a sound case supported by the Ecological Society, the Royal Society, but the political process just didn't allow us to succeed there. So I decided, you know, that a few scientists on their own are pretty politically impotent. So maybe if we joined up with a larger group like Forest and Bird, which has a very large membership, maybe we'd make more progress. So, yeah, I joined Forest and Bird as a result of losing the case with the Nadu, and that was very successful. I was national president for 5 years, and that was the time when we were promoting Southwest New Zealand World Heritage as a case for the society. And that was very rewarding, very challenging, but in the end very rewarding that against the odds we succeeded with Southwest New Zealand World Heritage. 2.6 million hectares, 10% of New Zealand in a World Heritage area, a very large proportion of the country, compared with what's been achieved elsewhere. And, you know, there was some concern at that in the early stages, but now I think everybody accepts it as being an area for very useful for sustainable tourism, for biodiversity and landscape protection and so on. And even the local West Coasters who were concerned at the initial stages are now very supportive of it.
Do you have a view on the tunnel and the monorail?
Yeah, I'm patron of the Save Fiordland group. Yeah, I can't see either of them, really. I mean, the monorail through Snowdon Forest, which is part of the World Heritage Area, it doesn't shorten the time to movement. In fact, there's about 5 minutes in it, I think. It diversifies it away from the road, but the road trip in itself is quite magnificent. So the destruction that monorail will do with all-terrain vehicles up the Vaughan area, and then a 20-kilometre monorail through the beech forest and wetlands and tussock grasslands there, coming out to the highway at Te Anau Downs, and there's still a two-hour bus trip to Milford beyond that. So the destruction there, I think, is unacceptable in terms of the gains to be made. The tunnel, I think, is it doesn't conform with, as I understand it, either the National Parks Act or the Conservation Act, certainly not with the management plans that are current for both Mount Aspiring and Fiordland National Park. And it's for one particular company, monopoly on transporting passengers shortest route from Queenstown to Milford. And yeah, I'm concerned with the parochialism in Queenstown. They seem to be for number one, and everybody else can go jump in the lake. And they seem a little concerned to share their tourism earnings with Tiano. And both of these routes will bypass. Both of these proposals will bypass Tiano. So the Tiano people are up in arms, and I'm very supportive of their concern, because I think the route round, the long route, it's a long route, but it's an interesting route. And shortening the route is really only going to shorten the stays of tourists in New Zealand. So, yeah, I'm opposed to both of those, really.
Now, one of the things, you've got a big launch coming up next week.
Yeah, well, there's a group of us, about 20 people around Otago, who have been concerned for some time about the sort of generally deteriorating environment and standard of living around New Zealand. And we had a public meeting at the university there 18 months ago and had a good turnout and a discussion, and the group's been active since then. So, we're launching an appeal next Friday, or Friday week, actually. It's called A Risk Assessment for New Zealand in Our Deteriorating World. We see symptoms in many facets of life. Environmental and ecological is one of my concerns, but economic security these days is pretty scarce, pretty delicate. The business community seems to have trouble with continuity and employment, and the energy issues and climatic security, the climate warming is a very serious threat. The greenhouse gas emissions are going up exponentially, and warming is occurring, and this government seems to be unable or unwilling to deal with that. We've virtually given away Kyoto. We've allowed the agricultural sector to increase indefinitely their carbon emissions without any penalty, and big industry is continuing, and we seem unwilling or unable to really bite the bullet and try to reduce carbon emissions. So, you know, the general well-being of the public in New Zealand, I think, like many parts of the world, is clearly beginning to suffer. So we see the need for a really comprehensive risk assessment for New Zealand. And for this, we're going to have a launch next Friday week, the 8th of March, an afternoon launch at 1:15 in the Museum Reserve. We have speakers coming in from Auckland and Palmerston North, two from Wellington, from Christchurch, and two or three from Dunedin. So it's a pretty impressive lineup. And we have some environmental lawyers giving us some advice. So we've got the afternoon launch in the Museum Reserve at 1:15, and then we've got an evening meeting at 7 o'clock in the Castle One Lecture Theatre, and the same people are presenting again, discussing at greater depth some of their concerns, and we'd like to sort of get something from this exercise as to where we go from here. We've already got more than 100 signatures of people expressing their support for what we're doing, and there's a website that's out there now which we'd encourage people to check over, and they can align themselves with the support for the organisation there. It's www.wiseresponse.org.nz, www.wiseresponse.org.nz, and there's some information there, and people can browse that and respond to that, and we hope for a good launch. We've invited all the political parties, and at this stage we've got positive responses from four of the leading parties, which will be represented by politicians. So we're addressing it not just at government, this is addressed to Parliament, to all the political parties. We think politicians in general have a responsibility here which we believe they should not avoid, and face up to a comprehensive risk assessment for New Zealand.
So you're asking, is there a request for the government to fund a major study? Is that the the hope?
To do a major study of where we're heading with our current trends and what the level of risk is. Because, you know, it seems to many of us that governments are behaving, certainly in New Zealand, as if there's no tomorrow. We seem to want to exploit everything that's exploitable in this generation. And most of us feel a responsibility for future generations so that they have as comfortable and enjoyable and exhilarating life in New Zealand as this generation has enjoyed. And the way we see things developing, you know, it seems to me that's not going to be possible. This generation is closing the options on so many issues for future generations that we believe there's a day of reckoning very close. And we believe the sooner we indulge in that day of reckoning, the better it will be for our future and for other generations yet to come.
Is there a danger, though, that the list of 100 people, while full of professors, I could get just dismissed as these people say no to everything?
These aren't people that say no to everything. These are a good cross-section of New Zealand citizens, from businessmen. They're not all academics by any means. There's businessmen there, there's farming communities, there's people in all walks of life. And we believe we've got a good cross-section. I mean, Manapouri revisited, if you like. I mean, with Manapouri, the country was persuaded to react, and that campaign was well recognised for having a full cross-section of the New Zealand community behind it. And, you know, we got sufficient support there that we persuaded the government of the day to have a different attitude. There was a change of government, and since then there have been other changes of government, and that decision has persisted right through several changes of government. So I think they all agree the right decision was made. Even the engineers agree the right decision was made. I finished up writing a paper with Dr. Keith Turner, who was CEO of Meridian Energy, on the outcome of Manapouri. We called it in conflict resolution, integrating conservation and development in a New Zealand national park, published in an American lake management journal. So, you know, we reached a compromise there after a huge battle and a lot of effort. And, of course, the nuclear, anti-nuclear campaign in the 80s was somewhat similar. A lot of public support persuaded the politicians that that it was their interest to recognise that public support, endorse it with a non-nuclear policy, and that's prevailed again through various changes of government.
So do you see this playing out, that it would sort of become election promises in the next election and then get done in the in the next cycle? Is that sort of time frame you're looking
at? That's one scenario. I mean, it's hard to predict how this thing would play out. All we're saying is that New Zealand needs to reassess its position as to where we're heading before we really reach a threshold that's beyond retrieval. And there's a lot of support for taking this approach, and we hope the politicians will see the need for it, respond to it, and because, you know, we've got so much history in New Zealand now, so much experience in New Zealand now, we know that if the public is of a mind to demand something and they've got the weight of numbers to do so, then the politicians will decide, will make the call. If there's not public support, then you're bleating in the wilderness, really. So we're out to inform the public what the issues are, try to bring the public on board, and if we can do that in sufficient numbers, then we'll, I think, persuade our politicians that we require them to take some action.
So, for one of my favourite lecturers, you don't seem to be slowing down any.
Well, I'm lucky, I suppose. You know, I look at the obituary notice of most mornings of the paper and say, oh, well, you know, my turn will be coming up soon, but until it does, life's too short to really, as I say, hang your boots up. There is so much out there encouraging involvement. And, while you can do it, I enjoy doing it. Life's too short to sit up and put your feet up and let the world go by.
Cool.
All right. Well, unfortunately, we have to wind the show up now. And thank you very much. We could have talked, I suspect, for another hour. I know we could have talked for another hour. But you've been listening to the Sustainable Lens on Otago Access Radio 105.4 FM. This has been the show for the 20th of February, 2013. Our guest was Emeritus Professor Sir Alan Mark. And our panelist was Professor Samuel Mann, and your host was me, Shane Gallagher. Our music is sourced from the Free Music Archive, and you can get podcasts of previous shows on sustainablelens.org, where you can subscribe in iTunes or on oar.org.nz, and we will put up the links to the website, the wiseresponse.org.nz, and put a link up to the event that Alan's been promoting. Thank you for listening, and we hope you enjoyed the show.
This program was first broadcast on Otago Access Radio and made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.